Mark asked me to talk about the conservative case for a carbon tax. It's a topic that I wrote quite a bit about at the Niskanen Center. I published a paper on that topic, which I know many of you are familiar with. I don't want to go through all of it. It would take too long. But the highlights of my argument is that there really is no conservative or liberal view of atmospheric physics. There is simply science. And the one thing that most of the scientists, even on the skeptic side of the argument, would accept is that there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty here. We know that when we put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, we are going to warm the atmosphere. We're going to warm the planet. The issue is how much warming and how quickly will it come and what will the ramifications of that warming be. Virtually all, though not entirely all, but virtually all of the skeptical scientific community accepts that narrative. The question is, what are the chances, what are the risks, and what are the ceilings and floors of that warming? So it's really an issue of how to manage uncertainty and how to manage risk. Now, oftentimes, conservatives have this conceit that somehow liberals or people who respond with concern to climate change, they're extremely risk-averse, and conservatives know they're more risk-tolerant. And this really is a question of normative risk preference, and there's no right or wrong way to look at risk. And so for conservatives, it's, you know, either argument is fine, but since they're the chesty conservatives who are willing to roll dice in life and live the American ethos of aggression, and I don't mean aggression in a bad sense, but this is the normative position for conservatives. But the interesting thing to me is that there's really no conservative risk tolerance and liberal risk aversion. It really depends on what issue you're looking at. So we're looking at foreign policy, for instance. All of a sudden, the roles are switched. It's conservatives who are risk-averse, and it's liberals who become risk-tolerant. Right after 9/11, Vice President Dick Cheney said this, quote, if there is a 1% chance that a Pakistani scientist are helping al-Qaeda build or develop a nuclear weapon, we have to treat it as a certainty in terms of our response. That's pretty amazing to me. I mean, here we have an issue in foreign policy which isn't all that different from the issue we confront in climate change, managing a great deal of uncertainty about a potentially extremely significant problem. And when it comes to foreign policy, Dick Cheney would never entertain these risks. When it comes to the environment, he will entertain these risks. So why is it that conservatives and liberals oftentimes have different views about risk tolerance when it comes to climate? And I think the main reason is the implications of what needs to be done if we're going to address the problem. For conservatives, abandoning fossil fuels, which is the only real way to address climate over some period of time, is something that's virtually unimaginable to them. And so they look at the policy landscape and say, well, we're going to give up a resource that has built the modern world. They're afraid that giving it up means that we turn back into some sort of pastoral world like the Amish in Pennsylvania. For what? For the mere chance that something may or may not prove disastrous down the road, and they're not willing to roll those dice. So that's the problem that we confront when talking to conservatives. The policy response to climate change takes them in directions they don't want to go. They don't want to see regulation of the economy. They don't want to give up the wealth creation of fossil fuels. They don't want to expand government because only government can address this problem. And so for all these reasons, conservatives go down a different path. So the argument that I've taken, beyond just the scientific discussion, which I don't need to brief you on, you're all as aware as I am of the scientific issues surrounding climate change, is that for conservatives, if you look at this issue in any other dimension, there would be a case for action. If we were in financial markets, we would find these sorts of risks all the time. Of course, they're not quite as cataclysmic as the risks of climate change, but people, when they invest their own money, they don't invest and take wild chances. We may know, for instance, the most likely outcome in any given year is that you'll get more money investing in stocks than in anything else. That's the norm. But we also know there's a great deal of variability, and there's all sorts of other potential outcomes in a given year with regards to investment, and investing in stocks can be disastrous if you don't hedge. And so people do hedge. They hedge in financial markets. We hedge in foreign policy. It only makes sense to hedge when it comes to the climate. So for reminding conservatives of that argument is very important. And then, of course, there's also the more direct point, which is that if we are wrong about climate change and it turns out that it's not as big a risk as scientists believe it to be, then we can always kill the tax. We can always repeal it, or we can undo the regulations, or the government response can go in reverse. But if climate change does prove to be as deleterious as mainstream scientists think, then we can't very well undo the experiment we're conducting on the planet. Only geoengineering promises that, and that is a very iffy and dangerous road to take. Even my friend Pat Michaels at the Cato Institute, who's one of the most prominent scientific skeptics in the country, cautions against conservatives jumping into the geoengineering game, and he thinks that it is arguably as dangerous as anything else that we could run on the, as an experiment on the planet. So I think this is a very important point, that when we're looking at the future, we have to understand what the implications are of being wrong. And, of course, the implications of being wrong when it comes to the climate is absolute disaster. So when we get into these arguments with conservatives, when I do, oftentimes we get to this point in the conversation, and then we have a long, drawn-out argument about the costs and benefits of acting. Now, of course, the problem here is that not only is the science greatly uncertain, but so are the economic implications of action. That's even more uncertain. Economic models which try to demonstrate the costs of climate change and the costs of addressing climate change are even more uncertain and even more speculative than is a great deal of the scientific work. So we really can't say a great deal with authority here. But what I try to hammer home to my libertarianish conservative friends, and I still consider myself a libertarian, though maybe not in the in the popular sense of the word now as far as it's defined by the libertarian movement, but the fact is that most libertarians, Tea Partiers, conservative Republicans, they argue that government's here for primarily one reason and one reason only. It's to protect our life, liberty, and property from trespass and violation from others. Well, that's exactly what's going on in greenhouse gas emissions. Greenhouse gas emissions are a violation of the rights to life, liberty, and property of the American people, in fact, the people all over the planet. And it's not enough to say, well, I guess Party A gets to harm Party B because Party A gains more than Party B loses. Conservatives would never embrace that argument. Libertarians would never embrace that argument in any other context. But when we get, but when they get into a conversation of costs and benefits for addressing climate, that's exactly what they're doing. They're entertaining the idea that people should be allowed to violate the rights to life, liberty, and property of others simply because it makes them a good profit, and the costs of doing something about that violation are greater than the benefits. We would never entertain that conversation in any other context. So why do I embrace a carbon tax as a remedy as opposed to, say, the Clean Power Plan or other regulatory approaches? Well, simply because as an economically minded libertarian, I understand that prices are extremely powerful things. If we were to try to eliminate fossil fuels from the economy through regulatory fiat, it would be a tremendous undertaking. It would be very complicated with thousands of pages of rules and regulations, and it would ask bureaucrats and regulators to undertake a mission that they're very poorly equipped to undertake. If we put a price on carbon, that immediately affects the decision-making of market actors all over the United States, and if we had it globally all over the world, and it promises far greater and faster remedies to greenhouse gas emissions than anything else we can undertake. Now, of course, the issue is where we put the tax. I know you've probably heard a lot of conversations about where a tax needs to be to achieve the emissions reductions we want. The problem is, if you look at the economic models, even that's very uncertain. It depends on how we think technology is going to go and where do you think price elasticity is going to be for various fuels that haven't even been invented yet. So we really don't know for certain. The best we can tell is that if we want to get on a road of abandoning fossil fuels by the end of the century, which is what scientists believe we have to do, then we can get there with a carbon tax of around $35 a ton in today's terms, increasing by 4% a year up through 2050. That puts us on a path to eliminating half of the greenhouse gas emissions in the United States where we could go in that direction. I'm not sure if that sort of tax is passable in the United States Congress, but at least it gives you an idea of what's required to hit the baseline, but there are big margins of errors on both sides. That it may turn out the tax needs to be higher. It may turn out that if energy efficiency is as economically feasible and affordable as some would argue, and that renewable and clean energies are as competitive as many environmentalists think, then the tax would not have to be quite so high. But we'll have to see how that plays out. But even putting that aside, I think that a strong argument with conservatives is that even if you reject the science surrounding climate change, and even if you think that the chances of deleterious climate change are greatly overblown, the reality is we are regulating greenhouse gases now. We do have a carbon tax. Now, it's simply hidden within the cost of regulation. And it's virtually impossible to imagine a world in which the regulation being undertaken to address climate change is undone. It would take an incredible series of events, all of which would be challengeable in court, even if you saw Donald Trump go into the White House and repeal the and try to repeal the endangerment finding at EPA, which unleashed the EPA regulation on climate change. That's subject to legal challenge. And when 97% of the peer-reviewed literature, which states a position on climate change, takes a position which is consistent with the EPA finding that greenhouse gases are indeed a danger to human health and welfare, it's very hard to imagine a judge ever letting that endangerment finding go away, absent a complete rewriting of the Clean Air Act, which, as long as there's 40 Democrats in the Senate, is never going to get past the filibuster. So the fact is, we are going to regulate greenhouse gases. We are regulating greenhouse gases now, and that cannot be unwound in any conceivable political universe that I live in. So for conservatives, the question is simply this. Would you rather regulate greenhouse gases in an expensive and efficient fashion, which is what we're doing with the Clean Power Plan, or which we're preparing to do with the Clean Power Plan, or would you rather use market mechanisms to address greenhouse gas emissions, which are far more efficient, far less costly, and far more effective at achieving the ends being advertised than are the regulations? Under that world, it seems amazing to me that conservatives continue to reject carbon taxes simply because they have this, in my opinion, a political fantasy about how someday the skeptics will be triumphant politically and rob the scientific community and mainstream understanding, and that we're on the cusp of completely reversing the regulatory attention around the greenhouse gases, which I find is absolutely implausible. But until conservatives are disabused of that fantasy, I have a feeling we're going to have quite a slog in front of us. Anyway, Mark, you only asked me for about 10 minutes, and I'm sure I've used pretty much all of that up, though there's a lot I didn't address, so let me just open it up for questions. And
let me just start with a couple of the ones that were asked most frequently. So our people in Alaska and a bunch of other chapters said, you know, the Alaska Permanent Fund is very popular. You know, it's obvious to people when they get a check. One of the reasons that we've always been in favor of people actually getting a dividend is we thought it would be the easiest way to maintain political support because people would see a check coming into their account. You know, I live in California. We have AB 32, which is a cap-and-trade law, and people get a credit on their electricity bill a couple times a year, but nobody knows it. So there was a huge opportunity of political will being generated that was missed by people not actually seeing a check. Secretary Shultz says the reason he's in favor of that is it's the hardest to rig, most transparent solution. I think, like a lot of conservatives who view this issue, you think a tax swap would be preferable, and could you just talk a little bit about why you prefer the tax swap over the dividend?
I don't necessarily prefer the tax swap over the dividend. My main interest is putting a price on carbon that is efficient enough to reduce the risk of catastrophic climate change to the greatest extent possible, period, full stop, and end of story. What we do with the revenue is a secondary and lesser important question to me. The main insight here is that the revenue that is derived from a carbon tax will be used to buy support for the carbon tax in Congress. That's how a carbon tax is going to happen. Now, what is the right allocation of carbon tax revenues to unlock the votes necessary to pass a carbon tax? I don't know. I think that the argument that is forwarded by CCL for a rebate is very compelling, and I agree with Secretary Shultz. It seems like a very airtight way of addressing conservative concerns that, one, this tax will impoverish the American people. No, it won't. The monies go back to the American people. So, now, of course, it'll be lumpy. Some people will pay more in taxes than they get in return in the rebate, but two-thirds of the people or so will get more in the rebate than they pay in the tax. So, you know, that addresses a very important concern very nicely. And secondly, it also addresses conservative concerns about the growth of government. If the revenue never gets to the Treasury in the first place, it can't be spent. So I find it a very compelling argument. But in Washington, compelling arguments a quarter buy you a cup of coffee. There are a lot of compelling arguments out there that don't get the time of day here in town. So the real issue is, what organized constituencies can you mobilize in support of a carbon tax with this, that, or the other allocation of capital? So a lot of the people I talk to in Washington, they're in favor of, you know, using the revenue to offset cuts in corporate income taxes or things like that because they believe that's the key to getting the business community behind the tax. And if you don't get the business community behind a carbon tax, then you are in deep trouble politically, because they have a lot of pull in the GOP and even in some parts of the Democratic Party as well. So you need to build constituencies for the tax. And so I'm in favor of however that allocation goes, I'm in favor of using it in a way that gets us a bill. And if a rebate is the key to getting that bill, fine with me. If a offsetting tax cut is the key for getting a price on carbon, fine with me too.
Great. Okay. Then, which kind of leads into another question I had, is we have a team inside the organization called the Endorser Team, and what they do is support the groups throughout the country, getting people to sign letters of endorsement, either just saying we need to take action on climate change or supporting our specific proposal. And I'm interested in your input on who you think the highest leverage type of people we could reach out to. Now, some of our chapters, I think, have done some really remarkable things. In Lehigh, Pennsylvania, they joined their local chamber of commerce. They had someone who was a former gas executive who joined their energy and environment committee. So it wasn't like somebody from the outside trying to get them to do something. It's, you know, now joining the chamber and then seeing if we can work on the chamber to get them to endorse what we're doing. Similarly, there's been really remarkable work with our Wisconsin group in Rotary, trying to do an enormous amount of outreach in Rotary. But who are the kinds of organizations, and can you give us some guidance on how we might reach out to significant individuals and organizations that would particularly provide support on the GOP side?
Well, on the Republican side of the aisle, electric utility companies are hugely influential at the state level, and they do have a great deal of power in Washington as well. And since they're the main entities that are wrestling with climate issues, if they were to support a carbon tax as preferable to, say, regulatory undertakings at EPA, that would be a major step. We've already seen that big oil, quote-unquote, is at least in theory in favor of carbon pricing. Now, of course, we haven't seen any specific proposals from ExxonMobil. But if you look at the statements of CEOs and the websites, you see a general agreement that carbon pricing is a way to go in addressing climate change, and generally a concession to climate change is a real problem that has to be addressed. So that's something. So energy companies are important. If energy companies endorse a carbon tax, that's three-quarters of the fight right there. So that's an obvious one. But one thing that I've noticed in American politics is that people follow leaders. Let me give you an example of something I found incredibly interesting. There was a survey done recently in which Republican activists were asked their opinion on single-payer health care, and only 16% of them supported single-payer health care. Of course, this shouldn't surprise. Opposition to expansion of government control of health care under the Affordable Care Act has been the bloody shirt of right-wing politics for the entirety of the Obama administration. But when they were told that Donald Trump supports single-payer, the numbers went to 44%. So what this tells you is that people on the right, just like people on the left and elsewhere, are far less ideological and entrenched in their views than you might think. They tend to be rather tribal in nature, and they support the position of the tribe. So if they like Donald Trump, then they're willing to even abandon something like opposition to single-payer health care, even in the GOP, even amongst Tea Party members. That's amazing to me, and that gives you an idea of the direction we need to go. We need to convince opinion leaders on the right. That's the main challenge. If opinion leaders on the right were to embrace carbon taxation, I think you would see a rapid shift. So if the people on Fox News started talking about this in a positive fashion, it would be a very significant thing. So that'd be my piece of advice on where to go.
Okay, that's phenomenal. And then the last one I think is probably pretty straightforward, but I had quite a few people ask me if a carbon tax were put in place, would you be in favor of eliminating all energy subsidies?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, when I was at the Cato Institute, even before I switched positions, I mean, for 20-odd years, I argued against government federal action to address greenhouse gas emissions. But even under that time at the Cato Institute, I argued for zeroing out energy subsidies across the board. In fact, I'll tell you a little story. About 15 years ago, I was in CNN green room going on TV, and in the room with me was Carl Pope, who was the president of the Sierra Club. And we started chatting, and it turned out that Carl tells me that he's in favor of eliminating energy subsidies across the board. And I said, well, that's remarkable. I never would have guessed that from Sierra Club. And he says, well, of course. said green energy is disadvantaged in the tax code, and more subsidies are going to nuclear and, you know, other forms of energy that are going to clean energy. So let's just zero it out and let the best fuel win. I'm pretty confident clean energy would win in a level playing field. So anyway, we agreed to work together, and even though the Cato Institute doesn't lobby for a living, we gave all as much intellectual support to the Sierra Club as we could and gave them some advice on where to go on the Hill to find Republican supporters of a bill. And their plan was to actually get this thing introduced and work it and not just, you know, make some statement of support and leave it at that. They were really going to move the bill. They couldn't find a single Republican to move that bill. Even my friend Jeff Flake, who is a libertarian-minded senator now from Arizona, then he was a congressman, wouldn't touch it. I mean, he thought about it, but he wouldn't introduce the bill. I was on a panel shortly thereafter with Denny Hastert when he was Speaker of the House, and Hastert thundered against the idea of zeroing out energy subsidies. So it's just amazing to me that Republicans, when they talk about the evils of government intervention in the economy, you know, everywhere else, but when it comes to energy, all of a sudden, no, government needs to be involved, and it needs to be picking winners, and it needs to have, you know, 5-year, 10-year, 20-year energy plans, and it needs to subsidize coal and nuclear and, well, and wind energy and solar. I mean, and the real debate in Washington is to what extent we're going to pull levers and throw help to this, that, or the other energy lobbyist. It's a terrible situation. So, yeah, in an ideal world, with a carbon tax is going to come a lot of other things with that bill, and zeroing out all subsidies, green and brown, would be a wonderful thing.
Great. Well, for anybody who's not following your organization, I recommend that you do. They are regularly putting out papers that I find very, very clear, very fresh, and useful, both on things I've read both on the U.S. and Canada recently. I thought that was a good piece also. So thank you for your extraordinary work, and the we loved watching that your organization get built, and look forward to working with you as we go along here. Thank you so much, Jerry.
Well, thank you, Mark. We enjoy working with you and look forward to doing more of the same down the road.
Okay. Thanks again for making yourself available on a Saturday. Really appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.